The Body, Cassette 3, 16. From The Revenge of Lardass Hogan by Gordon LaChance, originally published in Cavalier Magazine, March 1975, used by permission. They came up onto the platform one by one and stood behind a long trestle table covered with a linen cloth. The table was stacked high with pies and stood at the edge of the platform. Above it were looped necklaces of bare 100-watt bulbs, moths and night flyers banging softly against them and haloing them. Above the platform, bathed in spotlights, was a long sign which read, "The Great Gretna Pie Eat of 1960. To either side of this sign hung battered loudspeakers supplied by Chuck Day of the Great Day Appliance Shop. Bill Travis, the reigning champion, was Chuck's cousin. As each contestant came up, his hands bound behind him and his shirt front open, like Sidney Carton on his way to the guillotine, Mayor Charbonneau would announce his name over Chuck's PA system and tie a large white bib around his neck. Calvin Speer received token applause only. In spite of his belly, which was the size of a 20-gallon water barrel, he was considered an underdog, second only to the Hogan kid. Most considered Lardass a comer, but too young and inexperienced to do much this year. After Speer, Bob Cormier was introduced. Cormier was a disc jockey who did a popular afternoon program at WLAM in Lewiston. He got a bigger hand, accompanied by a few screams from the teenage girls in the audience. The girls thought he was cute. John Wiggins, principal of Gretna Elementary School, followed Cormier. He received a hearty cheer from the older section of the audience and a few scattered boos from the fractious members of his student body. Wiggins managed to beam paternally and frown sternly down on the audience at the same time. Next, Mayor Charbonneau introduced Lardass. "A new participant in the annual Great Gretna Pie Eat, but one we expect great things from in the future, young Master David Hogan." Lardass got a big round of applause as Mayor Charbonneau tied on his bib, and as it was dying away, a rehearsed Greek chorus, just beyond the reach of the 100-watt bulbs, cried out in wicked unison, "Go get 'em, Lardass!" There were muffled shrieks of laughter, running footsteps, a few shadows that no one could or would identify, some nervous laughter, some judicial frowns, the largest from His Honor Charbonneau, the most visible figure of authority. Lardass himself appeared not to even notice. The small smile greasing his thick lips and creasing his thick chops did not change as the mayor, still frowning largely, tied his bib around his neck and told him not to pay any attention to fools in the audience, as if the mayor had even the faintest inkling of what monstrous fools Lardass Hogan had suffered and would continue to suffer as he rumbled through life like a Nazi tiger tank. The mayor's breath was warm and smelled of beer. The last contestant to mount the bunting-decorated stage drew the loudest and most sustained applause. This was the legendary Bill Travis, 6 feet 5 inches tall, gangling, voracious. Travis was a mechanic at the local Amoco station down by the rail yard, a likable fellow if there ever was one. It was common knowledge around town that there was more involved in the Great Gretna Pie Eat than a mere $5. At least for Bill Travis, there was. There were two reasons for this. First, people always came by the station to congratulate Bill after he won the contest. And most everyone who came to congratulate stayed to get his gas tank filled. And the two garage bays were sometimes booked up for a solid month after the contest. Folks would come in to get a muffler replaced or their wheel bearings greased, and would sit in the theater chairs ranged along one wall. Jerry Molling, who owned the Amoco, had salvaged them from the old Gem Theater when it was torn down in 1957, drinking Cokes and Moxies from out of the machine and gassing with Bill about the contest as he changed spark plugs or rolled around on a crawly wheelie under someone's International Harvester pickup, looking for holes in the exhaust system. Bill always seemed willing to talk, which was one of the reasons he was so well-liked in Gretna. There was some dispute around town as to whether Jerry Molling gave Bill a flat bonus for the extra business his yearly feat, or yearly eat if you prefer, brought in, or if he got an out-and-out raise. Whatever way it was, there could be no doubt that Travis did much better than most small-town wrench jockeys. He had a nice-looking two-story ranch out on the Sabattis Road, and certain snide people referred to it as the house that Pies built. That was probably an exaggeration, but Bill had it coming another way, which brings us to the second reason there was more in it for Travis than just $5. The Pie Eat was a hot wagering event in Gretna. Perhaps most people only came to laugh, but a goodly minority also came to lay their money down. Contestants were observed and discussed by these bettors as ardently as thoroughbreds are observed and discussed by racing touts. The wagerers accosted contestants' friends, relatives, even mere acquaintances. They pried out any and all details concerning the contestants' eating habits. There was always a lot of discussion about that year's official pie. Apple was considered a heavy pie, apricot a light one, although a contestant had to resign himself to a day or two of the trots after downing 3 or 4 apricot pies. That year's official pie, blueberry, was considered a happy medium. Bettors, of course, were particularly interested in their man's stomach for blueberry dishes. How did he do on blueberry buckle? Did he favor blueberry jam over strawberry preserves? Had he been known to sprinkle blueberries on his breakfast cereal? Or was he strictly a bananas and cream sort of fella? There were other questions of some moment. Was he a fast eater who slowed down, or a slow eater who started to speed up as things got serious, or just a good, steady, all-around trencherman? How many hot dogs could he put away while watching a Babe Ruth League game down at the St. Dom's baseball field? Was he much of a beer drinker? And if so, how many bottles did he usually put away in the course of an evening? Was he a belcher? It was believed that a good belcher was a bit tougher to beat over the long haul. All of this and other information was sifted, the odds laid, the bets made. How much money actually changed hands during the week or so following Pie Night, I have no way of knowing. But if he held a gun to my head and forced me to guess, I'd put it at close to $1,000. That probably sounds like a pretty paltry figure, but it was a lot of money to be passing around in such a small town 15 years ago. And because the contest was honest, and a strict time limit of 10 minutes was observed, no one objected to a competitor betting on himself. And Bill Travis did so every year. Talk was, as he nodded, smiling to his audience on that summer night in 1960, that he had bet a substantial amount on himself again, and that the best he had been able to do this year was 1 for 5 odds. If you're not the betting type, let me explain it this way. He'd have to put $250 at risk to win 50. Not a good deal at all, but it was the price of success. And as he stood there, soaking up the applause and smiling easy, he didn't look too worried about it. "And the defending champion," Mayor Charbonneau trumpeted, "Gretna's own Bill Travis." "Ooh, Bill, how many are you going through tonight, Bill? You going for 10, Billy boy? I got a 2-spot on you, Bill. Don't let me down, boy. Save me one of those pies, Trav." Nodding and smiling with all proper modesty, Bill Travis allowed the mayor to tie his bib around his neck. Then he sat down at the far right end of the table, near the place where Mayor Charbonneau would stand during the contest. From right to left them, the eaters were Bill Travis, David Lardass Hogan, Bob Cormier, Principal John Wiggins, and Calvin Speer holding down the stool on the far left. Mayor Charbonneau introduced Sylvia Dodge, who was even more of a contest figure than Bill Travis himself. She had been president of the Gretna Ladies Auxiliary for years beyond telling, since the first Manassas, according to some town wits, and it was she who oversaw the baking of each year's pies, strictly subjecting each to her own rigorous quality control, which included a weigh-in ceremony on Mr. Banchichek's butcher's scales down at the Freedom Market. This to make sure that each pie weighed within an ounce of the others. Sylvia smiled regally down at the crowd, her blue hair twinkling under the hot glow of the light bulbs. She made a short speech about how glad she was that so much of the town had turned out to celebrate their hardy pioneer forebears, the people who made this country great. For it was great, not only on the grassroots level where Mayor Charbonneau would be leading the local Republicans to the hallowed seats of town government again in November, but on the national level, where the team of Nixon and Lodge would take the torch of freedom from our great and beloved general and hold it high for... Calvin Speer's belly rumbled noisily. Warp. There was laughter, and even some applause. Sylvia Dodge, who knew perfectly well that Calvin was both a Democrat and a Catholic, Either would have been forgivable alone, but the two combined, never, managed to blush, smile, and look furious, all at the same time. She cleared her throat and wound up with a ringing exhortation to every boy and girl in the audience, telling them to always hold the red, white, and blue high, both in their hands and in their hearts, and to remember that smoking was a dirty, evil habit which made you cough. The boys and girls in the audience, most of whom would be wearing peace medallions and smoking not camels but marijuana in another 8 years, shuffled their feet and waited for the action to begin. "Less talk, more eatin'," someone in the back row called, and there was another burst of applause. It was heartier this time. Mayor Charbonneau handed Sylvia a stopwatch and a silver police whistle, which she would blow at the end of the 10 minutes of the all-out pie eating. Mayor Charbonneau would then step forward and hold up the hand of the winner. "Are you ready?" His Honor's voice rolled triumphantly through the great day PA and off down Main Street. The five pie-eaters declared they were ready. "Are you set?" His Honor inquired further. The eaters growled that they were indeed set. Down street, a boy set off a rattling skein of firecrackers. Mayor Charbonneau raised one pudgy hand and then dropped it. "Go!" Five heads dropped into five pie plates. The sound was like five large feet stamping firmly into mud. Wet chomping noises rose on the mild night air and then were blotted out as the bettors and partisans in the crowd began to cheer on their favorites. And no more than the first pie had been demolished before most people realized that a possible upset was in the making. Lard Ass Hogan, a 7-to-1 underdog because of his age and inexperience, was eating like a boy possessed. His jaws machine-gunned up crust. The contest rules require that only the top crust of the pie be eaten, not the bottom. And when that had disappeared, a huge sucking sound issued from between his lips. It was like the sound of an industrial vacuum cleaner going to work. Then his whole head disappeared into the pie plate. He raised it 15 seconds later to indicate he was done. His cheeks and forehead were smeared with blueberry juice, and he looked like an extra in a minstrel show. He was done. Done before the legendary Bill Travis had finished half of his first pie. Startled applause went up as the mayor examined Lardass's pie plate and pronounced it clean enough. He whipped a second pie into place before the pacemaker. Lardass had gobbled a regulation-sized pie in just 42 seconds. It was a contest record. He went at the second pie even more furiously yet, his head bobbing and smooching in the soft blueberry filling, and Bill Travis threw him a worried glance as he called for his second blueberry pie. As he told friends later, he felt he was in a real contest for the first time since 1957, when George Gamache gobbled three pies in 4 minutes and then fainted dead away. He had to wonder, he said, if he was up against a boy or a demon. He thought of the money he had riding on this and redoubled his efforts. But if Travis had redoubled, Lardass had trebled. Blueberries flew from his second pie dish, staining the tablecloth around him like a Jackson Pollock painting. There were blueberries in his hair, blueberries on his bib, blueberries standing out on his forehead, as if, in an agony of concentration, he had actually begun to sweat blueberries. "Done!" he cried, lifting his head from his second pie dish before Bill Travis had even consumed the crust on his new pie. "Better slow down, boy," His Honor murmured. Charbonneau himself had $10 riding on Bill Travis. "You gotta pace yourself if you want to hold out." It was as if Lardass hadn't heard. He tore into his third pie with lunatic speed, jaws moving with lightning rapidity, and then... But I must interrupt for a moment to tell you that there was an empty bottle in the medicine cabinet at Lardass Hogan's house. Earlier, that bottle had been three-quarters full of pearl-yellow castor oil, perhaps the most noxious fluid that the good Lord in his infinite wisdom ever allowed upon or beneath the face of the earth. Lardass had emptied the bottle himself, drinking every last drop and then licking the rim, his mouth twisting, his belly gagging sourly, his brain filled with thoughts of sweet revenge. And as he rapidly worked his way through his third pie, Calvin Speared, dead last as predicted, had not yet finished his first, Lardass began to deliberately torture himself with grisly fantasies. He was not eating pies at all. He was eating cow flops. He was eating great big gobs of greasy Grammy gopher guts. He was eating diced up woodchuck intestines with blueberry sauce poured over them. Rancid blueberry sauce. He finished his third pie and called for his fourth, now one full pie ahead of the legendary Bill Travis. The fickle crowd, sensing a new and unexpected champ in the making, began to cheer him on lustily. But Lardass had no hope or intention of winning. He could not have continued at the pace he was currently setting if his own mother's life had been the prize. And besides, winning for him was losing. Revenge was the only blue ribbon he sought. His belly groaning with castor oil, his throat opening and closing sickly, he finished his fourth pie and called for his fifth, the ultimate pie. Blueberries become Electra, so to speak. He dropped his head into the dish, breaking the crust and snuffled blueberries up his nose. Blueberries went down his shirt. The contents of his stomach seemed to suddenly gain weight. He chewed up pasty, pastry crust and swallowed it. He inhaled blueberries. And suddenly, the moment of revenge was at hand. His stomach, loaded beyond endurance, revolted. It clenched like a strong hand encased in a slick rubber glove. His throat opened. Lardass raised his head. He grinned at Bill Travis with blue teeth. Puke rumbled up his throat like a 6-ton Peterbilt shooting through a tunnel. It roared out of his mouth in a huge blue and yellow glurt, warm and gaily steaming. It covered Bill Travis, who only had time to utter one nonsense syllable. Goog was what it sounded like. Women in the audience screamed. Calvin Speer, who had watched this unannounced event with a numb and surprised expression on his face, leaned conversationally over the table as if to explain to the gaping audience just what was happening, and puked on the head of Marguerite Charbonneau, the mayor's wife. She screamed and backed away, pawing futilely at her hair, which was now covered with a mixture of crushed berries, baked beans, and partially digested frankfurters. The latter two had been Cal Speer's dinner. She turned to her good friend Maria Lavin and threw up on the front of Maria's buckskin jacket. In rapid succession, like a replay of the firecrackers, Bill Travis blew a great and seemingly supercharged jet of vomit out over the first two rows of spectators, his stunned face proclaiming to one and all, "Man, I just can't believe I'm doing this." Chuck Day, who had received a generous portion of Bill Travis's surprise gift, threw up on his hush puppies and then blinked at them wonderingly, knowing full well that stuff would never come off suede. John Wiggins, principal of Gretna Elementary, opened his blue-lined mouth and said reprovingly, "Really, this has..." as befitted a man of his breeding, a position he did it on his own pie plate. His Honor Charbonneau, who found himself suddenly presiding over what must have seemed more like a stomach flu hospital ward than a pie-eating contest, opened his mouth to call the whole thing off and upchucked all over the microphone. "Jesus, save us," moaned Sylvia Dodge, and then her outraged supper, fried clams, coleslaw, butter and sugar, corn, 2 years' worth, and a generous helping of Muriel Harrington's Bosco chocolate cake, bolted out the emergency exit and landed with a large wet splash on the back of the mayor's Robert Hall suit coat. Lardass Hogan, now at the absolute apogee of his young life, beamed happily out over the audience. Puke was everywhere. People staggered around in drunken circles, holding their throats and making weak, cawing noises. Somebody's pet pecking knees ran past the stage, yapping crazily, and a man wearing jeans and a Western-style silk shirt threw up on it, nearly drowning it. Mrs. Brockway, the Methodist minister's wife, made a long, basso-belching noise, which was followed by a gusher of degenerated roast beef and mashed potatoes and apple cobbler. The cobbler looked as if it might have been good when it first went down. Jerry Molling, who had come to see his pet mechanic walk away with all the marbles again, decided to get the righteous fuck out of this madhouse. He got about 15 yards before tripping over a kid's little red wagon and realizing he had landed in a puddle of warm bile. Jerry tossed his cookies in his own lap and told folks later he only thanked Providence he had been wearing his coveralls. And Miss Norman, who taught Latin and English fundamentals at the Gretna Consolidated High School, vomited into her own purse in an agony of propriety. Lardass Hogan watched it all, his large face calm and beaming, his stomach suddenly sweet and steady, with a warm balm it might never know again. That balm was a feeling of utter and complete satisfaction. He stood up, took the slightly tacky microphone from the trembling hand of Mayor Charbonneau, and said, "I declare this contest a draw." 17. Then he puts the mic down, walks off back of the platform, and goes straight home. His mother's there on account of she couldn't get a babysitter for Lardass's little sister, who was only 2. And as soon as he comes in, all covered with puke and pie drool, still wearing his bib, she says, "Davy, did you win?" But he doesn't say a fucking word, you know. He just goes upstairs to his room, locks the door, and lays down on his bed. I downed the last swallow in Chris's Coke and tossed it into the woods. "Yeah, that's cool. Then what happened?" Teddy asked eagerly. "I don't know." "What do you mean you don't know?" Teddy asked. "I mean, it's the end. When you don't know what happens next, that's the end." "What?" Vern cried. There was an upset, suspicious look on his face, like he thought maybe he'd just gotten rooked playing penny-up bingo at the Topsham Fair. "What's all this happy-crappy? How'd it come out?" "You have to use your imagination," Chris said patiently. "No, I ain't," Vern said angrily. "He's supposed to use his imagination. He made up the fucking story." "Yeah, what happened to the cat?" Teddy persisted. "Come on, Gordy, tell us." "I think his dad was at the pie eat, and when he came home, he beat the living crap out of Lardass." "Yeah, right," Chris said. "I bet that's just what happened." "And," I said, "the kids went right on calling him Lardass, except that maybe some of them started calling him Puke Your Guts, too." "That ending sucks," Teddy said sadly. "That's why I didn't want to tell it." "You could have made it so he shot his father and ran away and joined the Texas Rangers," Teddy said. "How about that?" Chris and I exchanged a glance. Chris raised one shoulder in a barely perceptible shrug. "I guess so," I said. "Hey, you got any new Lidio stories, Gordy?" "Not just now. Maybe I'll think of some." I didn't want to upset Teddy, but I wasn't very interested in checking out what was happening in Lidio either. "Sorry you didn't go for this one better." "No, it was good," Teddy said. "Right up to the end, it was good. All that puking was really cool." "Yeah, that was cool. Really gross," Vern agreed. "But Teddy's right about the ending. It was sort of a jip." "Yeah," I said, and sighed. Chris stood up. "Let's do some walking," he said. It was still bright daylight, the sky a hot, steely blue, but our shadows had begun to trail out long. I remember that as a kid, September days always seemed to end much too soon, catching me by surprise. It was as if something inside my heart expected it to always be June, with daylight lingering in the sky until almost 9:30. "What time is it, Gordy?" I looked at my watch and was astonished to see it was after 5. "Yeah, let's go," Teddy said. "But let's make camp before dark so we can see to get wood and stuff. I'm getting hungry, too." 6:30, Chris promised. "Okay with you guys?" It was. We started to walk again, using the cinders beside the tracks now. Soon the river was so far behind us we couldn't even hear its sound. Mosquitoes hummed and I slapped one off my neck. Vern and Teddy were walking up ahead, working out some sort of complicated comic book trade. Chris was beside me, hands in his pockets, shirt slapping against his knees and thighs like an apron. "I got some Winstons," he said. "Hawked them off my old man's dresser. One apiece, for after supper." "Yeah, that's boss." "That's when a cigarette tastes best," Chris said. "After supper." "Right." We walked in silence for a while. "That's a really fine story," Chris said suddenly. "They're just a little too dumb to understand." "No, it's not that hot. It's a mumbler." "That's what you always say. Don't give me that bullshit you don't believe. You gonna write it down, the story?" "Probably, but not for a while. I can't write 'em down right after I tell 'em. It'll keep." "What Vern said about the ending being a jip, yeah?" Chris laughed. "Life's a jip, you know it? I mean, look at us." "Ah, we have a great time." "Sure," Chris said. "All the fucking time, you wet." I laughed. Chris did, too. "They come out of you just like bubbles out of soda pop," he said after a while. "What does?" But I thought I knew what he meant. "The stories. That really bugs me, man. It's like you could tell a million stories and still only get the ones on top. You'll be a great writer someday, Gordy." "No, I don't think so." "Yeah, you will. Maybe you'll even write about us guys if you ever get hard up for material." "I have to be pretty fucking hard up," I gave him the elbow. There was another period of silence, and then he asked suddenly, "You ready for school?" I shrugged. Whoever was, You got a little excited, thinking about going back, seeing your friends. You were curious about your new teachers and what they would be like. Pretty young things just out of teacher's college that you could rag, or some old topkick that had been there since the Alamo. In a funny way, you could even get excited about the long, droning classes, because as the summer vacation neared its end, you sometimes got bored enough to believe you could learn something. But summer boredom was nothing like the school boredom that always set in by the end of the second week. And by the beginning of the third week, you got down to the real business. Could you hit Stinky Fisk in the back of the head with your art gum while the teacher was putting the principal exports of South America on the board? How many good loud squeaks could you get off on the varnished surface of your desk if your hands were real sweaty? Who could cut the loudest farts in the locker room while changing up for phys ed? How many girls could you get to play Who Goosed the Moose during lunch hour? Higher learning, baby. Junior high, Chris said. And you know what, Gordy? By next June, we'll all be quits. What are you talking about? Why would that happen? It's not going to be like grammar school, that's why. You'll be in the college courses. Me and Teddy and Vern will all be in the shop courses, playing pocket pool with the rest of the retards, making ashtrays and birdhouses. Vern might even have to go into remedial. You'll meet a lot of new guys, smart guys. That's just the way it works, Gordy. That's how they got it set up. Meet a lot of pussies, is what you mean, I said. He gripped my arm. No, man, don't say that. Don't even think that. They'll get your stories, not like Vern and Teddy. Fuck the stories. I'm not going in with a lot of pussies, no, sir. If you don't, then you're an asshole. What's asshole about wanting to be with your friends? He looked at me thoughtfully, as if deciding whether or not to tell me something. We had slowed down. Vern and Teddy had pulled almost half a mile ahead. The sun, lower now, came at us through the overlacing trees in broken, dusty shafts, turning everything gold. But it was a tawdry gold. Dime store gold, if you can dig that. The tracks stretched ahead of us in the gloom that was just starting to gather. They seemed almost to twinkle. Star pricks of light stood out on them here and there, as if some nutty rich guy, masquerading as a common laborer, had decided to embed a diamond in the steel every 60 yards or so. It was still hot. The sweat rolled off us, slicking our bodies. It's asshole if your friends can drag you down, Chris said finally. I know about you and your folks. They don't give a shit about you. Your big brother was the one they cared about. Like my dad when Frank got thrown into the stockade in Portsmouth. That was when he started always being mad at us other kids and hitting us all the time. Your dad doesn't beat on you, but maybe that's even worse. He's got you asleep. You could tell him you were enrolling in the fucking shop division, and you know what he'd do? He'd turn to the next page in his paper and say, "Well, that's nice, Gordon. Go ask your mother what's for dinner. And don't try to tell me different. I've met him." I didn't try to tell him different. It's scary to find out that someone else, even a friend, knows just how things are with you. You're just a kid, Gordy.
Gee, thanks, Dad.
I wish the fuck I was your father, he said angrily. You wouldn't go around talking about taking those stupid shop courses if I was. It's like God gave you something, all those stories you can make up, and he said, "This is what we got for you, kid. Try not to lose it." But kids lose everything, unless somebody looks out for them. And if your folks are too fucked up to do it, then maybe I ought to. His face looked like he was expecting me to take a swing at him. It was set and unhappy in the green-gold late afternoon light. He had broken the cardinal rule for kids in those days. You could say anything about another kid. You could rank him to the dogs and back, but you didn't say a bad word ever about his mom and dad. That was the fabled automatic. The same way not inviting your Catholic friends home to dinner on Friday unless you checked first to make sure you weren't having meat was the fabled automatic. If a kid ranked out your mom and dad, you had to feed him some knuckles. Those stories you tell, they're no good to anybody but you, Gordy. If you go along with us just because you don't want the gang to break up, you'll wind up just another grunt making C's to get on the teams. You'll get to high and take the same fucking shop courses and throw erasers and pull your meat along with the rest of the grunts. Get detentions, fucking suspensions. And after a while, all you'll care about is getting a car so you can take some skag to the hops or down to the fucking Twin Bridges Tavern. Then you'll knock her up and spend the rest of your life in a mill or some fucking shoe shop in Auburn. Or maybe even up to Hillcrest plucking chickens. And that pie story will never get written down. Nothing will get written down. Because you'll just be another wise guy with shit for brains. Chris Chambers was 12 when he said all that to me. But while he was saying it, his face crumpled and folded into something older, oldest, ageless. He spoke tonelessly, colorlessly, but nevertheless, what he said struck terror into my bowels. It was as if he had lived that whole life already. That life where they tell you to step right up and spin the wheel of fortune, and it spins so pretty, and the guy steps on a pedal, and it comes up double zeros. House number, everybody loses. They give you a free pass, and then they turn on the rain machine. Pretty funny, huh? A joke even Vern Tessio could appreciate. He grabbed my naked arm, and his fingers closed tight. They dug grooves in my flesh. They ground at the bones. His eyes were hooded and dead. So dead, man, that he might have just fallen out of his own coffin. I know what people think of my family in this town. I know what they think of me and what they expect. Nobody even asked me if I took the milk money that time. I just got a 3-day vacation. Did you take it? I asked. I had never asked him before. And if you had told me I ever would, I would have called you crazy. The words came out in a little dry bullet. Yeah, he said. Yeah, I took it. He was silent for a moment, looking ahead at Teddy and Vern. You knew I took it. Teddy knew. Everybody knew. Even Vern knew, I think. I started to deny it, and then closed my mouth. He was right. No matter what I might have said to my mother and father about how a person was supposed to be innocent until proved guilty, I had known. Then maybe I was sorry and tried to give it back, Chris said. I stared at him, my eyes widening. You tried to give it back? Maybe, I said, just maybe. And maybe I took it off to old Lady Simons and told her. And maybe the money was all there, but I got a 3-day vacation anyway, because the money never showed up. And maybe the next week old Lady Simons had this brand new skirt on when she came to school. I stared at Chris, speechless with horror. He smiled at me, but it was a crimped, terrible smile that never touched his eyes. Just maybe, he said, but I remember the new skirt. A light brown paisley, sort of full. I remembered thinking that it made old Lady Simons look younger, almost pretty. Chris, how much was that milk money? Almost $7. Christ, I whispered. So just say I stole the milk money, but then old Lady Simons stole it from me. Just suppose I told that story. Me, Chris Chambers, kid brother of Frank Chambers and Eyeball Chambers. You think anybody would have believed it? No way, I whispered. Jesus Christ. He smiled his wintry, awful smile. And do you think that bitch would have dared try something like that if it had been one of those douchebags from up on the View that had taken the money? No, I said. Yeah. If it had been one of them, Simons would have said, Okay, we'll forget it this time, but we're going to spank your wrist real hard, and if you ever do it again, we'll have to spank both wrists. But me... Well, maybe she had her eye on that skirt for a long time. Anyway, she saw her chance, and she took it. I was a stupid one for even trying to give that money back. But I never thought that a teacher... Oh, who gives a fuck anyway? Why am I even talking about it? He swiped an arm angrily across his eyes, and I realized he was almost crying. Chris, I said, why don't you go into the college courses? You're smart enough. They decide all of that in the office. And in their smart little conferences, the teachers, they sit around in this big circle jerk, and all they say is, yeah, right. All they give a fuck about is whether you behaved yourself in grammar school and what the town thinks of your family. All they're deciding is whether or not you'll contaminate all those precious college course douchebags. But maybe I'll try to work myself up. I don't know if I could do it, but I might try. Because I want to get out of Castle Rock and go to college, never see my old man or any of my brothers again. I want to go someplace where nobody knows me and I don't have any black marks against me before I start. But I don't know if I can do it. Why not? People. People drag you down. Who? I asked, thinking it must mean the teachers or adult monsters like Miss Simons, who had wanted a new skirt, or maybe his brother Eyeball, who hung around with Ace and Billy and Charlie and the rest. Or maybe his own mom and dad. But he said, Your friends drag you down, Gordy. Don't you know that? He pointed at Vern and Teddy, who were standing and waiting for us to catch up. They were laughing about something. In fact, Vern was just about busting a gut. Your friends do. They're like drowning guys that are holding onto your legs. You can't save them. You can only drown with them.
Come on, you fucking slow pokes, Vern shouted, still laughing.
Yeah, coming,
Chris called, and before I could say anything else, he began to run. I ran too, but he caught up to them before I could catch up to him. 18. We went another mile, and then decided to camp for the night. There was still some daylight left, but nobody really wanted to use it. We were pooped from the scene at the dump and from our scare on the train trestle, but it was more than that. We were in Harlow now, in the woods. Somewhere up ahead was a dead kid, probably mangled and covered with flies. Maggots, too, by this time. Nobody wanted to get too close to him with the night coming on. I had read somewhere, in an Algernon Blackwood story, I think, that a guy's ghost hangs out around his dead body until that body is given a decent Christian burial. And there was no way I wanted to wake up in the night and confront the glowing, disembodied ghost of Ray Brower, moaning and gibbering and floating among the dark and rustling pines. By stopping here, we figured there had to be at least 10 miles between us and him. And, of course, all four of us knew there were no such things as ghosts, but 10 miles seemed just about far enough in case what everybody knew was wrong. Vern, Chris, and Teddy gathered wood and got a modest little campfire going on a bed of cinders. Chris scraped a bare patch all around the fire. The woods were powder dry, and he didn't want to take any chances. While they were doing that, I sharpened some sticks and made what my brother Denny used to call pioneer drumsticks, lumps of hamburger pushed onto the ends of green branches. The three of them laughed and bickered over their woodcraft, which was almost nil. There was a Castle Rock Boy Scout troop, but most of the kids who hung around our vacant lot considered it to be an organization made up mostly of pussies, arguing about whether it was better to cook over flames or over coals, a moot point, we were all too hungry to wait for coals, whether dried moss would work as kindling, what they would do if they used up all the matches before they got the fire to stay lit. Teddy claimed he could make a fire by rubbing two sticks together. Chris claimed he was so full of shit he squeaked. They didn't have to try. Vern got the small pile of twigs and dry moss to catch from the second match. The day was perfectly still, and there was no wind to puff out the light. We all took turns feeding the thin flames until they began to grow stouter on wrist chunks of wood fetched from an old deadfall some 30 yards into the forest. When the flames began to die back a little bit, I stuck the sticks holding the pioneer drumsticks firmly into the ground at an angle over the fire. We sat around watching them as they shimmered and dripped and finally began to brown. Our stomachs made pre-dinner conversation. Unable to wait until they were really cooked, we each took one of them, stuck it in a roll, and yanked the hot stick out of the center. They were charred outside, raw inside, and totally delicious. We wolfed them down and wiped the grease from our mouths with our bare hands. Chris opened his pack and took out a tin Band-Aids box. The pistol was way at the bottom of his pack. He opened it and gave each of us a battered Winston. We lit them with flaming twigs from the fire and then leaned back, men of the world, watching the cigarette smoke drift away into the soft twilight. None of us inhaled because we might cough, and that would mean a day or two of ragging from the others. And it was pleasant enough to just drag and blow, hawking into the fire to hear the sizzle. That was the summer I learned how you can pick out someone who is just learning to smoke. If you're new at it, you spit a lot. We were feeling good. We smoked the Winstons down to the filters, then tossed them into the fire. Nothing like a smoke after a meal, Teddy said.
Fucking A, Vern agreed.
Crickets had started to hum in the green gloom. I looked up at the lane of sky visible through the railroad cut and saw that the blue was now bruising toward purple. Seeing that outrider of twilight made me feel sad and calm at the same time. Brave, but not really brave. Comfortably lonely. We tromped down a flat place in the underbrush beside the embankment and laid out our bedrolls. Then, for an hour or so, we fed the fire and talked. The kind of talk you can never quite remember once you get past 15 and discover girls. We talked about who was the best dragger in Castle Rock, if Boston could maybe stay out of the cellar this year, and about the summer just passed. Teddy told about the time he had been at White's Beach in Brunswick, and some kid had hit his head while diving off the float and almost drowned. We discussed at some length the relative merits of the teachers we had had. We agreed that Mr. Brooks was the biggest pussy in Castle Rock Elementary. You would just about cry if you sassed him back. On the other hand, there was Miss Cody. She was just about the meanest bitch God had ever set down on the earth. Vern said he'd heard she hit a kid so hard 2 years ago that the kid almost went blind. I looked at Chris, wondering if he would say anything about Miss Simons, but he didn't say anything at all. And he didn't see me looking at him. He was looking at Vern and nodding soberly at Vern's story. We didn't talk about Ray Brower as the dark drew down, but I was thinking about him. There's something horrible and fascinating about the way dark comes to the woods. It's coming unsoftened by headlights or streetlights or houselights or neon. It comes with no mother's voices calling for their kids to leave off and come on in now to herald it. If you're used to the town, the coming of the dark in the woods seems more like a natural disaster than a natural phenomenon. It rises like the Castle River rises in the spring. And as I thought about the body of Ray Brower and its light, or lack of it, what I felt was not queasiness or fear that he would suddenly appear before us a green and gibbering banshee whose purpose was to drive us back the way we had come before we could disturb its peace, but a sudden and unexpected wash of pity, that he should be so alone and so defenseless in the dark that was now coming over our side of the earth. If something wanted to eat on him, it would. His mother wasn't here to stop that from happening, and neither was his father, nor Jesus Christ in the company of all the saints. He was dead, and he was all alone, flung off the railroad tracks and into the ditch. And I realized that if I didn't stop thinking about it, I was going to cry. So I told a Ladillo story, made up on the spot and not very good. And when it ended, as most of my Ladillo stories did, with one lone American dog face coughing out a dying declaration of patriotism and love for the girl back home into the sad and wise face of the platoon sergeant, it was not the white, scared face of some PFC from Castle Rock or White River Junction I saw in my mind's eye, but the face of a much younger boy, already dead. His eyes closed, his features troubled, a rill of blood running from the left corner of his mouth to his jawline. And in back of him, instead of the shattered shops and churches of my Ladillo dreamscape, I saw only dark forest and a cindered railway bed bulking against the starry sky like a prehistoric burial mound. 19. I came awake in the middle of the night, disoriented, wondering why it was so chilly in my bedroom and who had left the windows open, Denny, maybe. I had been dreaming of Denny, something about body surfing at Harrison State Park. But it had been 4 years ago that we had done that. This wasn't my room, this was someplace else. Somebody was holding me in a mighty bear hug. Somebody else was pressed against my back, and a shadowy third was crouched beside me, head cocked in a listening attitude.